You are listening at KBOL Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial. This is Talking Earth. I'm your board op, Patrick Picard. KBOO is one of the few radio stations in town that never runs automation at night. There is always a real person making radio for you, which we've done for over 50 years. Every day, live and local DJs captivate you with music you won't hear repeated over and over. You help KBOO air music that is inventive, creative, and informed with your membership. Right now, going on right now, is the KBOO Spring Membership Drive. We ask you to go to kboo.fm/giveto and become a member. Your support gives the KBOO airwaves life all night long. Your support is the reason that Talking Earth is still here. Your support is the reason that spoken word radio still exists in this town. That's kboo.fm/give. After these messages, you're going to hear Amanda and Sophia with poet Wendy Chin Tanner.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, this month featuring soul, rhythm and blues, and folk singer Chris Webster. Webster draws from many genres, sometimes backing her songs on uke or even washboard, with Nina Gerber on guitars. Gerber honed her skills accompanying folk singer Kate Wolfe. She has accompanied and recorded with Carla Bonoff, Peter Rowan, Nancy Griffith, Greg Brown, and many others. The Portland Folk Music Society concert is April 19th, 7:30 p.m., at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele Street in Portland. For more information, go to the website, kboo.fm, and click on Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Eco Film Festival from Friday, April 19th through Sunday, April 21st at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. The Portland Eco Film Festival celebrates Earth Day 2019 with a weekend of films including a special 420 screening of Dreams, a documentary about Brazilian modernist landscape designer Roberto Burle Marx and the world's first giraffeologist who fought for women's rights in scientific fields, and more. Again, that's Portland Eco Film Festival from Friday, April 19th through Sunday, April 21st at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, you're listening to Talking Earth on KBOO. I'm your host, Amanda Hellstrom White. And tonight we have Wendy Chin Tanner, who's reading from her book, Anyone Will Tell You.
And I'm Sophia Hellstrom White, the other host of the evening, but back to Amanda, because she's better at this.
I wouldn't go that far. But Wendy is a Brooklyn, New York poet who lived briefly in Portland.
Six years.
Hey, that's, briefly for some people. But who is visiting us and gracing us with her presence for AWP. And
we're visiting you from the past.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah. We're recording this in the past, and then it's going to be recorded or
presented
in the future. Wow. Such a professional. And Wendy's like, what did I set myself up for? And Wendy's going to talk about her book tonight and read some great poetry from it. And we're looking forward to that. So, Wendy, why don't you take it away? And
maybe you could tell us a little bit about
you and your book and anything that you want to, and then read some stuff from it. So that'd be great.
Thanks, you two. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much for having me. This is my first time on KBOO, which is amazing considering my wonderful years in Portland. I am so happy to bring you my second book baby, Anyone Will Tell You, which is also from Sibling Rivalry Press. Unlike my first book, Turn, which was more narrative lyrical verse, this book experiments more with form. Some of the poems are in blank verse couplets, and some of the poems are in a form that I developed that I like to call three by threes, or really trisyllabic tercets. They consist of three lines per stanza and three syllables per line. So a lot of these poems that you'll be hearing are in that form. This book also deals with a lot of contradictions, the relationships between things like the past and the present, parent and child, the earth and the universe, human beings and our planet. It also deals with gender and race and infertility and miscarriage.
So light stuff.
Light stuff. Yeah, you know how I roll. So I think I'm going to kick off with one of my favorite poems of the book. I think that in our culture, motherhood is something that is like a blank canvas that we project all kinds of fantasies and images and discourses and narratives onto. So this poem is called, "The mother in this poem is me or you or your mother." Mother is a falling star, a bead of sweat, of blood, of bread, our daily bread on which we fed. The thread of life, the trouble and strife, of he you wed with heart and head, you pledged in daddy's bed, there is no rest for wickedness, lest evil eye pry babe from breast again. I rest my case on wave and wind. Hey knight, hey knave, come save me, blame me for sin of rage, its wage so high I am both monster and slave. Shame me, slay me. This is the labyrinth where you play Theseus and I play Minotaur. It's okay. It's just a metaphor.
It's really good.
Right in the feels.
Thanks, you too.
I'd feel weird clapping. I really want to.
You could snap. That's something that I learned that people do at poetry readings last night.
That's a different genre that for poetry than I'm used to. It's a snapping culture. But.
So this poem calls to some of the kind of landmarks of my inner universe, I guess. I spent 15 years of my life in the UK, so there are these little Easter eggs in it that call back to that life for me. One of them is Cockney rhyming slang. Do you know it a bit?
I'm familiar of it.
Yeah, so trouble and strife is wife.
Right.
Yeah, so I kind of shoved that one in there. And there's a lot of imagery, too, from the classics, from, of course, Theseus and the Minotaur. And also there's a line that calls back to a Catullus poem. He is a very important poet for me. Yeah. Should I read another?
Yes, please do. Of course.
Okay. So, leading on from that theme of motherhood and of failure of motherhood, last night was the supermoon and the vernal equinox, so I wanted to read a poem, or actually to read two poems that are moon poems. First one is Blue Moon. After the appointed fuck, I wander the house barefoot, climbing up, peering out every window, until I find you in the attic skylight, to the right of my desk, your light not blue but milky white, filtered through a call. Your body is pale, full-bodied, but scarred. You're old, I suppose, a sterile rock. I sit in the dark and watch as we both turn. You, a helium balloon whose string tugs at the fist of a fussy child who might look up at the sky and let go. Supermoon. The night abides, making the window pane a mirror, mirroring my pale face, black hair, brown eyes. Time normalizes everything, even these months and months of nothing, the colossal space between moons and stars. We should be able to bear it, this moon burning outside the window, yellower, leaning closer than ever before, circling us, circling the unseen sun. And in the lightless world within, a miniature moon floats in my womb's slippery night. Heart beating time. Time beating heart.
Beautiful. Mark Twain was totally wrong about moon poems. You ever hear, familiar with his comment?
Where no.
He said, war talk by people who have been at war is always more interesting than moon talk by poets that have never been to the moon. But
what a mansplainer.
I know.
Let's
he totally proved
shove him out on an ice floe.
Exactly.
So speaking of mansplaining, one of the things that I always like about you is your social justice stuff.
Thank you.
I follow you on Facebook, and you're, you know, not afraid to speak your mind about social justice issues and things like that.
And tell certain people where to stick it if they need
if you
the,
need to.
The mouth, it is big.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Me too. That's one of the things I think we have in common.
That's
so
at least three people in this room.
So I was wondering if you have any poems in there in your book that speak to you about social justice issues or things like that.
Hoo boy.
I think that's a yes.
Funny that you should ask. I have a couple of Me Too poems in this book, actually, that are important to me. I think the first one I'll read is called Who's Afraid? And it speaks to the systems that enable abuse, particularly in families, but I think that can also extend to greater organizational systems, right? I think we can think of the family unit as almost like a microcosm of how we organize larger systems and organizations in our social sphere.
I totally cried when you read this last night. But
did you?
I tried not to show it because my makeup was too good. There's a bunch of reasons why it hit me, but yeah.
Who's afraid? Who is the wolf at the table? Who pretends there is no wolf? Who's afraid of the wolf who eats at the table? So I wonder if what you were reacting to was the undercurrent of gaslighting and silencing that the poem speaks to.
That's part of it. And also for me, it was like I endured similar instances due to a family member when I was young. And part of it was that person was liked in the community.
And also
it's like, you know, there's after effects because, you know, I was considered a boy at the time. And, you know, when I came out, it was like there were some people that I knew from back home still wondered if that was a side effect of the damage inflicted by someone. So that's the important aspect of the Me Too movement is you have to, we need to talk about the fact that certain things leave long-term impacts.
Absolutely.
So thank you for reading that. And sorry to interject too much.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, yeah. Judith Herman in Trauma and Healing, which is a real touchstone text for me, talks about how we heal through making meaning of our experience. So that's what we're doing here.
Yeah.
I think maybe a twin to that poem in the book is another Me Too poem that speaks more to what happens to whistleblowers, the price of it. Let's see if I can find it. How it is written. The cuckoo in the nest has got a big mouth, a beehive like a buzz in the body of the things left unsaid. Say it. This is how It is written.
I got it.
Thank you. Yeah, when I first read that poem out, it was during the Kavanaugh hearings. So it took on a particular resonance, actually, for me.
I feel so many people were traumatized due to that.
Mm.
Due to that. So that was the perfect time for you to read that.
Yeah, so it was I think, a national display of the weight that is born, not only psychically but in the body. You know, the body remembers, right? And that's what the line about the beehive and the buzz. Mm-hmm. That's what we carry within us when it's unsaid.
Yeah.
Amanda, you were talking about other social justice poems. Other topics that the book touches upon are global warming, climate change, and the effects of that actually upon mass migration and mm-hmm. populations. one of the poems that I wanted to read for you tonight is about that specifically. It's called Velleity, which means wish or desire. And I wrote it as a love poem to Oregon, really. I knew I was leaving mm-hmm. when I wrote it. And it was inspired by a trip to the Oregon coast where I witnessed this incredible natural phenomenon. Thousands upon thousands of these little blue jellyfish called Velella Velella were beached on the shore. And I understand that that was happening all up and down the shore. And it happens just normally and always has, but it had happened much more frequently, I believe, right around that year. And some people were attributing that to global warming. And witnessing just all of this death on the shore during the time that I think it was the apex of the Syrian refugee crisis was incredibly moving to me because it made me think of the relationship between the ocean and immigration and the relationship too between the Pacific Ocean and immigration with respect to where my people are from mm-hmm. and those journeys. And so I wrote this poem, Velleity, which means wish or desire. Because life began in the sea, death seems natural. On the beach, the waves call the names of the dead. Velella, Velella, by the wind sailors, sea rafts, blue sails beached by the billions. A bright blue whale exploded fractally. The fault of nobody, not you or me, or the inscrutable Pacific. This is what happens when you are born with a sail set in one direction. See, the sea connects the continents by water salty as red, and those soft bodies seep venom onto skin if touched. For nothing is innocent, not tangled seaweeds named green rope or wireweed or bladder rack or hiding in the blades trapping prey. Pray, do you believe in prayer? There in books, in genetic epistemology, scraping my inner cheeks, bloodletting. I'm testing, 1, 2, 3. Is this poem a poem about me or the sea? You see how I always place myself back at the center. I myself am the center, myself the middle kingdom of this poem. I must insist. Queen of the jellyfish.
I would snap, but I can't.
Yeah, I can't snap. Patrick, you snap for us. I'm like, this person who has functional thumbs, because apparently mine don't.
Mine don't snap.
I'd be the worst member of the Addams family ever. So,
what's the thing? One thing you miss the most about Portland?
Oh, food. Food.
I never thought I'd hear a New Yorker say that.
Well, you know, I have two kids, and so I think that Portland has so many family-friendly restaurants that are of such incredibly high quality that are still affordable that you know, that really sets it apart from anywhere else I've ever lived. And we miss so many restaurants here. And also the people, you know, we made some really, really good friends here, and we miss them. And it's lovely to be seeing them right now.
Well, we're all very, you know, I don't want to speak for all your friends, but we're very
I'm sure that the rest of them are happy to see you too. So
all of them are. So
yeah,
I'm sure. Yeah, food was probably the thing I put up here too.
So. Yeah, that's always the thing that I miss when I go someplace else. Yeah. And I miss about
even
Portland.
When you went to Seattle.
Yeah. So
not going to tackle that too much because we don't want to start a war with the other.
Yeah, we don't want to start a war with Seattle. City,
well, the accessibility of nature too. I mean, yeah. it's all around us in a way that isn't the case in many other cities where you have to drive to anything.
So.
Yeah, I used to live within walking distance of Forest Park, and that was incredible.
That yes, that's inspiring of jealousy. So I mean. I used to live in that area too, years back. But should we get back to topic?
Yeah,
ones?
Yeah. So, So your first book, Turn, is really a really great book. But what inspired you to go in this direction as opposed to the direction that
as opposed to more you know, more lyrical narrative as your first one? I guess asking what. Made you more interested in forms this time around?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, I think that was really a driving force in terms of dictating the shape of this book. I wrote the majority of the poems in this book after the birth of my second daughter, Lucy. And she was a marsupial baby, meaning, you know, she needed to be in the baby carrier, otherwise the child would not sleep. So I would spend hours and hours a day pacing the halls with her in the baby carrier, and I would have my iPhone with me. And so there was something about the kinetics of that sort of like bounce walking, the repetitive motion of that. It's almost like a walking meditation, you know, along with the constraints of the little iPhone notes app page, you know, where when I started composing, when I started, you know, hearing verse and I wanted to write it down, the form of the notes app kind of dictated really short lines and really fluid structure. And I only had one hand, so it was really hard to do capitalizations. It was really hard to do punctuation. Sure. And that became part of the form. I just kind of stripped it very, very bare.
Right.
And I wound up with these 3x3 poems, these poems that were very rhythmic, very musical, 3 syllables per line, 3 lines per stanza. And that was really attributed to the physical and technological constraints around its composition.
Well, one thing I'll say before I ask about more poems is, or ask for more poems, is a while back Amanda and I were discussing, when we were at some reading or another, how, I mean, it's great to want to show technical prowess. And, I mean, usually impressed by it. But we were talking about how some people who like to show off their technical prowess don't often give strong, like, emotional or personal qualities. So it's something that's refreshing about this book is you always inject a lot of what at least feels personal. And
oh, it's absolutely, it's incredibly personal. I mean, but still, that's where it begins, though, right? Like, it's got to begin with the emotion. There's no reason for the poem to be out there otherwise.
But it's still written with a scalpel, is what we thought, technically, and sharp-wise, so.
Thank you.
And if I request something,
please do.
Since you were saying, like, sort of the genesis of this was taking care of one of your children, how about some motherhood poems?
Sure thing. So here are a couple of poems that I wrote for Lucy, who was born in 2014, after a very long, long, long wait. Child, I am the grape. You are the wine. crush me. This next poem is called This Bed, This Room, and it was inspired by my love of John Donne, actually.
What's not to like about John Donne?
I just really love his love poems, and he has this one line in a poem called The Sun Rising where he says, "She is all states and all princes I, nothing else is. Shine on us and thou art everywhere. This bed, thy temple is, these walls, thy sphere." And so I was inspired to write a poem that was not a love poem to a partner, but a love poem to a baby. This bed, this room, hourglass sands, scratched skin of night, the thin scrim between dark and dawn, flight of bat wings, meadowlark songs, shark fin slice, moon moving scythe to spoon, round this bed, this room, round clock measuring tide and rest, starfish on sand, her splayed hand, my breast.
Wonderful.
I often think about something that my mentor, one of my many poetry mentors, said to me years ago, which I think about often as a kind of touchstone for should this poem be out there or should it not? And he talked about whether to ask yourself whether or not you're writing a poem to the universe or whether you're writing a diary poem. Mm-hmm. So are you speaking to something that is more than yourself? Yeah. Or are you speaking to something that you just need to kind of get out for yourself? Mm-hmm. And if it's the latter, then, you know, you can keep it in your diary. But if you're digging deep into something personal, that rings the bell of something universal, then that says to you that that poem or that piece needs to be out in the world.
Your two books are very divergent. So what is your next project?
The project that I'm working on right now is actually prose, believe it or not. And I'm in the second draft. I'm 40% through the second draft of my first novel, which is historical fiction based on a true story. Set in the 1950s in New York City and in Carville, Louisiana, at the Federal Institution for the Treatment of Leprosy, which may be a surprising and dark topic, but actually my dad was a patient there for 9 years, from 1954 to 1963, and he not only gave me carte blanche to write about his experience or write the story based on his experience, but he went with me a year and a half ago to Carville, which is no longer a hospital but now has a museum and archives attached to it. So that was his first time back since 1964. And we went there together for a week, and he helped me get hundreds and hundreds of pages, basically, of research material. And it was really amazing. The thing about that place that was so resonant to me is that, you know, it was a mythological place to me. I had always known about it, and I had always heard about how incredibly beautiful it is. It's on the banks of the Mississippi in a disused plantation, and it was in many ways like a prep school or a country club almost, rather than like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And by the time my dad got there, it was very patient run. It was like almost like an intentional living community, except for the fact that everyone who lived in that community was sick and that they were incarcerated, essentially. There was a fence that was around it. And, you know, I think that I bring my background as a sociologist to bear a lot in my writing, just as a way to understand my own experience, but also to understand kind of general human experience. Because, you know, I think growing up with this family secret, because it was a family secret, even though my dad and I spoke very openly about it, but I knew not to talk about it because there was actually an injunction when he left, the protocol told him by the social workers when he was discharged was, if you want to re-enter society, if you want to be able to have a job and a normal life, never speak of this experience. So there was this institutionalized form of gaslighting and silencing, right? But within our family, we had honesty around it. So, you know, for me as a child and then growing up into an adult, to try and reconcile the blatant, like, strangeness and there's something kind of like operatic and hyperbolic about it, right? Like, to of all the things, leprosy, right? Which actually is called Hansen's disease. People yes. who have Hansen's disease feel like the term leper and leprosy is like a slur.
Yeah, right.
But historically speaking, you know, it's important to use the term leprosy because that's, you know, that was within the cultural context. But you know, there's something so it is a metaphor for stigma. Right? Like, leprosy is not only stigmatized, but it is the metaphor for stigma. Mm-hmm. So I felt like that was just impossible not to write about this. Initially, I was going to write this book as nonfiction. But then once I began, it told me that it needed to be fiction, just in order to give myself permission to find the story in it, right? Rather than to have to be quite so to honor the absolute events that happened, right? Like, I needed to afford myself the freedom to invent.
Right, inventing aspects. Action in some ways makes it more personal because you own a chunk of it that way.
Right. That's actually very true because, I mean, if you think about novels in the same way that, you know, you think about Jungian interpretation of dreams, everything in your novel is you, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
That way, yeah.
I look forward to reading it.
I can't wait.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, I'm not, like, pushing you because I know it's going to happen at its own pace, but I can't wait.
Well, I'm doing my best to push it through. And, you know, it's not just all doom and gloom. There's also plenty of sex. I mean, the part in Carville is about four teenage friends, and there is a love story
right.
within that section. And the part in New York City is about an illicit love affair, actually,
nice.
Between the parent of one of the kids and a woman that is not the mother of his children.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that's... It's going to be juicy. And
it's going to be juicy. It's juicy, I think.
And so, would you like to read some more?
Yeah, absolutely.
I won't goad you into a specific topic this time. You
no
treat us.
Well, how about I read another Oregonian poem since we're here?
That okay. sounds good.
Okay. Another poem, I think, about the Oregon coast, since that was such a fertile place for my imagination. On the Oregon coast in fall, you gather a bucketful of seashells, shaped like ears, whorled, tender cochlea. Hour by hour, the sea yields feast and famine simultaneously, clusters of agates and fields of shattered crab carcasses. You follow a stream strewn with agates, rough, hewn from sandstone cliffs that give them up more easily than basalt bluffs. Gleaming, they lure you on and on. But plain black rocks will also shine when wet, and sand fleas swarm balletically over the dead at the water's edge, licking clean the innards of abandoned shells. Are they not beautiful? A shell is most valuable in the fast fading time between the death of the animal inside and the crushing blows of the tide rolling into itself. It's really light.
Well, you were reading things like that last night, and someone else was reading a seashell poem or something about oysters. And I totally wrote something in my head while you were there, so I'll be posting it later. But I was like, I hope it's not offensive to write something while someone else is reading something. It totally is meant as inspiration.
No, I mean, I think that poetry speaks to... poems speak to one another, right? I mean, that's kind of how the forum is built.
I hope so.
It's conversational.
So one of the things that you also do with your husband is comic book stuff. And
we're both huge comic geeks. So.
And I really enjoyed the anthology that you guys released on Kickstarter, the last one.
All We Ever Wanted.
All We Ever Wanted. And I wanted to know if you wanted to talk about that at all, or, you know.
Oh, sure. Yeah, interestingly, it just so happens that we are at a period of growth with the company, which is called A Wave Blue World. Tyler, my husband, and I founded it in 2005 when he was leaving art school. And it is obviously a mom and pop shop. And it was just the two of us pretty much until now. And we're making a big leap. We've just taken on board a new head of sales and marketing and a new head of editorial. And we're really excited about that. And that will, I think, allow all of us to be able to do what we do best rather than my poor husband trying to be a one-man band. It's, you know, incredibly difficult to really grow as a company when you're doing that, when you're doing all of the admin and all of the management and, you know, literally everything. So as far as my role is concerned, I'm also expanding that a little bit in terms of acquisitions. We're thinking about doing more hybrid genre, which is exciting, and sort of, you know, maybe doing some anthologies of women poets and pairing them with artists and seeing what we can come up with there. And definitely being more upfront with the fact that A Wave Blue World is about social justice. It's about a progressive agenda. It's a company that is deeply committed to providing a platform for a multitude of voices.
Which is great. You and Tyler created a graphic novel together, didn't you?
American
Terrorist,
right.
I believe it's called?
Yeah, which is about domestic terrorism. I mean, I would say that was mostly him. My contribution was, you know, 70% editorial.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, we certainly bounced ideas off each other. And, you know, again, it has like a strong social justice bent, and it has... Not in a sort of like didactic message-driven way, but it's really about, you know, what happens when people are put in these extraordinary circumstances. What happens when regular people are pushed by life change?
Right. And I mean, allegedly that's what comics are about, anyways. The idea that you take a normal person, at least Stan Lee era and that kind of thing, and you know, I think the best possible thing, most refreshing thing to hear is, I think we discussed this some last night, poetry and comics is a combination. And I mean, I personally think all poets should read comic books anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that there's a lot of relationality between the forms, you know, because they're both visual media in some ways, right? Like, there are many poems that are page poems where the poet is guiding your eye across the page in various ways, and it's interpreted differently when you see it from how you hear it.
Right.
And that's also obviously true about good narrative storytelling, or sequential storytelling, rather. You know, the artist is guiding your eye from panel to panel.
Yeah.
So I think I really kind of learned a lot from working in graphic novels in that sense.
And you know, in a more... And they're both kind of about creating realities and selling them
absolutely.
To someone else.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, I mean, it's rooted in the idea that storytelling and narrative is what underpins reality, right? We begin with formulating ideas and Those ideas can lead us to understanding experiences that are beyond our own. It creates empathy, and from that, we can shape material reality.
Exactly.
Right? Like in social science, we have this saying, words make worlds, mm-hmm. right? So words and pictures make worlds.
So,
would you like to read some more?
Yeah, sure thing. I would love to read some more.
We'd love to hear you read some more.
I'm going to read a poem that's a little bit more about astrology and astronomy. Mercury in Virgo. Are one of you?
She's a Virgo.
Oh, there we go. My mother and my younger daughter, Lucy, are both Virgos, so I know a lot about Virgos. Mercury in Virgo. Night devours sleep. The hours surfeited, glut-drenched time. Sweat-slick skin, sheet metal, rainwater, shine. I walk Widdershins, warding off terrors, thought crimes. Later, at the end of a dream, the stars in a cloudless sky form a filigree above the skein of swans. Honk and echo, fragments of the past, its light can still prick, stinging rapidly moving eyes. I wanted to read, too, a poem that I wrote for my best friend, Veronica Davidov, who is an anthropologist, my first reader of everything, mm-hmm. and also an amazing photographer. She did the cover image of this book, as well as the cover image for Turn. I think that there aren't too many poems out there that are written about female friendship. There are a few. There's a Louise Glick poem that I really love that's about female friendship, but there aren't a ton. You know, there's a ton of love poems, there's a ton of poems about death, there's a ton of moon poems, but there aren't too many, yeah.
And there's a lot of, like, poems about the friendship between guys. But it's just,
yeah,
it's obviously disproportionate.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. So I wanted to rectify that a little bit with this poem. How the Sea. Woe woven, we are rain wet wool. Wait and weft, we wait for no one, waiting for wreck. The rocks break no matter what they say. You don't know what you don't know. How do you do this? How do you show me myself, long past due? The distance between us, the distance between two seas. I see it clearly tonight, the mirror through the window, the gloom of the year, its gloaming gleams of glitter, the stars a streak, ribbon of silver, the river. You see how it runs to the sea. You see how the sea, too, is a mirror. I think that's what friends do for each other. They mirror you back to yourself.
The best ones, yes. I agree. I never actually thought of it that way until I was hearing you read that. And I was like, yeah. I mean, the best friendships where you're like, yeah. I mean, I also, like, at my best, it's like I steal aspects that I like from friends to, like, improve myself, I think, sometimes. Mm. Or people I'm married to.
Should I do another?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Shall I do... I think I'll do the poem after which the book is named. Anyone will tell you. Nearly night. The sky bleached to winter. White over black water. Soft of wind from box fans. Speaking tongues to the heat of bodies. Of beds and rooms rising. Twice the moon rose this month. Twice I spoke platitudes on time and the color blue. Outside the vault of sky, dark blue violet, blushed, bruised, violent. There's never only one. Anyone will tell you. Skin of dust on liquid, dusk covered, I fall, and fallen thus after fall. It will be the middle of my life. One of those days become one of these.
Thank you. You're listening to Talking Earth on KBOO. I'm Amanda Hellstrom-White with Sophia Hellstrom-White, and we have Wendy Chin Tanner, who is reading from her book, Anyone Will Tell You. And I'm just going to talk to Wendy a little bit more about her experiences as a writer. So I know that everybody, you know, like wrote in like high school and stuff, but when was the first time you really decided that you wanted to become a professional writer?
A professional writer. I think I knew that I wanted to be a writer from a super young age, from, you know, maybe age 5 or 6. I think that I got the idea that I could be a professional writer, and I sort of, you know, fathomed of how it might be possible, probably in high school, actually, when I started to take it more seriously, and I had a couple of teachers who took me seriously and, you know, encouraged me to submit my work to literary contests and things like that. I won the National Scholastic Writing Award when I was in high school, so that was kind of, you know, a big self-esteem booster in terms of thinking that, you know, maybe this could be a career. I wish somebody had told me that poetry, you can't really eat from poetry alone.
Yeah.
I wish someone had, like, really explained to me that, you know, you need all these side hustles in order to do it. So I had, I was fortunate enough to have a really lovely early career in poetry. In college, I went to Cambridge University in the UK, and there is a literary journal there, the Mays Anthology of Oxford and Cambridge, which is kind of where people get discovered. That's so I had a poem in that, and I was approached by an agent straight out of undergrad, and you know how they tell you never go with the first guy you meet?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you go with the first guy you met?
That happened. So, yeah, I mean, I was too immature, I think, to know that I had the right to pick and choose and to kind of, you know, really think for myself whether or not it was a good fit. I was just so pleased to be asked, and I treated him kind of like a professor, like somebody that I had to please, or like my boss, when really your agent is your partner, right? Your right. business partner. And I was too young and naive to know that, and didn't really have the mentorship that would have explained that to me. And it was a poor fit. It was right. a poor fit. And he wanted me, of course, not to write poetry, even though he signed me off of a poem. But, you know, he wanted to eat, too, oddly enough. And I had done some a lot of student theater and some student film, and I had worked in the summers as a production assistant on a couple of movies in New York. So he said, okay, why don't you try to write a script? And I did, and the script, I finished it, and the script had an Asian American male lead. And he said, Wendy, I can't sell this. And this was, you know, in the late 90s. And I think it's only really until now with Crazy Rich Asians that maybe people are not going to keep saying that
it's
to
so
writers.
It's so frustrating that, you know, it's happened that long. It's been going this long. I mean, you could say that much more than me even, but I find it frustrating. It's like Bruce Lee created Kung Fu, but they were like, we can't sell it with you in it. So they...
Exactly. Yeah.
David Carradine.
So he dropped me. And I did not get back on the horse. I took that as a sign that, you know, this isn't for me, so I'm not good at this. You know, I guess I will just go back to school and do something that's solid, like my parents told me I should. So I didn't even go back to the English department. I went to the sociology department and spent 10 years doing that. I didn't write for 10 years. Because this one man told me that he couldn't sell my work. So, I mean, I think that that really is a lesson to not just listen to that one man. One, don't go with the first guy who asks.
Right.
And two, you know, if it doesn't work out, get back on the horse.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's like, here I am wanting to call him everything I can't say on the radio. But I'm glad you got back into it. I mean,
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, I think sometimes things happen for a reason. I think that, you know, the social science definitely makes its way into my work. And I think that I'm a bit of a late bloomer, perhaps. You know, not everyone has the same sort of trajectory. You know, I think I needed to mature, and I think I needed to have that time to find my center and my confidence in this difficult business.
Right.
So maybe that's not such a bad thing.
Yeah.
That it took 10 years.
That's true. I'm still getting used. You know, I've been involved in readings for like 17 years, and I still am getting used to the idea of poetry as a business. So.
Yeah.
It's still weird, isn't it? It's like there's the intimate moment of like writing something and then maybe reading it in front of people. And then when you think about publishing, it's like getting ready to play hockey or something, you know, put on the mask, get ready for a fight.
Yeah, well, I try to think of it as a conversation. I mean, that's the thing that enables me to do it, you know, because I also experience that sort of disjuncture and that sort of like feeling of being torn away from the part that I like most, which is being alone and composing the work, you know, like right. That's where I get the biggest rush of endorphins and stuff. It's really when I'm in that flow state and something's working, and that's really only 10% of the time, but yeah. You know, I chase that. I think we all chase that as writers, that those fleeting moments where you're riding the wave and you're like, you know, really surfing it and you're on top of the world, right?
That's what makes us keep doing it, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So sometimes I kind of feel like I'm being torn away from that wonderful place in order to then have to like dance on the pole for the books. But once I'm in it, though, once I've made that transition,
yeah.
And I think of it as having conversations, you know, having these intimate conversations with the audience and connecting. If I just think about it in terms of connection, then it's okay.
Good move.
Okay. So do you have like a website or a blog or anything like that that people can follow you on?
I do. Well, I'm on Facebook. You can find me on Facebook. I'm also on Instagram under my name's Wendy Chin Tanner. I have an author website, which is wendychintanner.wixsite.com. Actually, let's double check that. I think there's like a / author. Yes. So it's wendychintanner.wixsite.com. And you can also find the comics at awbw.com.
We have a few minutes left. Do you want to
read some more?
Yeah,
absolutely.
I want to get as much of the Wendy poems as possible. Here,
so. Okay, let's start with the first poem of the book, Gathering. I awake before the final hush of the night's lassitude drains away thicker than water and simplicity of sunlight knifed through blinds. Why did I dream about landed fish fins flapping in the dirt, the wings of flightless birds, so many useless things gathering? Shall I read another Oregonian poem?
Sure.
Agate Beach. The traveler need not journey on. The traveler's journey is one of return. If not agates, then barnacles. If not sweet-smelling seaweed, then shattered shells. The traveler need not journey on. If not mussels, then sea glass. If not smooth surfaces, then rocks pocked by anemones. The traveler's journey is one of return. A dead, dungeness crab bobs in the spume. waterlogged, it still rises and falls. The traveler's journey is one of return. The traveler need not journey on. In a tidal pool, an orange sea star supplies a sun for another sky. The traveler's journey is one of return. We rinse the sand from our souvenirs and lose half the agates in our hands. The traveler need not journey on. We take what we can, rain boots filled with rocks and shells. We carry our wet socks. The traveler need not journey on. The traveler's journey is one of return.
Oh, I wish I could read that.
We really appreciate you taking your time to come and be on
our little show,
Talking Earth.
This is our fourth show, so I mean, this show has been going on for a long time, but
this is our fourth show with just the two of us hosting. So, yeah.
And the wonderful Patrick Bocard
in the back,
being the engineer and main person.
And so do you have anything else that you want to promote or say, or you know?
I mean, yeah. Get your book.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. So,
where can we find your book?
Anyone will tell you. You can find it at the Sibling Rivalry Press website, which I can find for you. It's siblingrivalrypress.bigcartel.com, and you can find both of my books there. Anyone will tell you, as well as Turn, and you can also find the book on Amazon. Although it's always better to get small press books directly from the publisher, it's better for both the author and the publisher.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And then, yeah. Well, it was really great to see you and to hear you read. And
we would, you know, like ask you to promote readings that you're doing around town, but we know this will show up probably a month from now.
But people should check out your website so they can see where you're going to be in New York and in your area. So.
Yes, I will say that I don't update my website as much as I should. And really the best way to know where I'm going to be is from social media, from Instagram and from Facebook, where you can find me at Wendy Chin Tanner.
Yeah.
Just my name.
Do the Google.
Yes, exactly.
Well, thanks very much for being here with us tonight. And I really enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to your new book when it comes out. And
April 12th.
So
wow, that's just right.
And I assume like us Portlanders might be able to find it at like Powell's Books.
Yes, you should be able to find it at Powell's.
Mm-hmm. I mean, again, it's always best to buy directly from the publisher. But it's like sometimes we have to do our seamster thing, buy from our bookstore that we like to brag about.
So, well, thanks very much, Wendy. And
you're listening to KBOO FM, right?
And Talking Earth. Have a great night.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Greenline, an environmental justice dinner series on Thursday, April 18th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Abundant Life Church in Portland. Greenline features Amira Streeter, natural resources policy advisor to Governor Brown, and Edward Hill, urban planner and community systems designer. These leaders will discuss pressing environmental issues impacting communities of color and vulnerable communities in Portland and in Greater Oregon. Again, that's Greenline, an environmental justice dinner series on Thursday, April 18th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Abundant Life Church, 3935 North Lombard Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.